The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hello, Dr. Ray. I'm sure I'm going to get really good advice from you.
Why do I have to be the insightful professional?
Thank you for empowering me.
Here's what I think is going on.
I think you're a hoot and a half.
My idea, my theory, my guidance is a bit of a stretch.
I just love your show.
Does that comfort you?
No.
Am I close?
No.
You are really smart.
I am sensitive and understanding and nurturing.
Your show to me is like a comedy information show.
Did I make you feel a lot better or what?
No, you made me feel worse.
Now, from the studios of Living Bread Radio Network in Canton, Ohio, the hometown of Mother Angelica, here's Dr. Ray.
Well, medicine makes you feel worse, too. Can. But then in the long run, hopefully, it makes you feel better. Surgery hurts. But in the long run, it may take care of the problem. At least that's what I'm relying on. This is Dr. Ray Guarendi. Thank you for joining me on The Doctor Is In, the Friday version. Look back Friday. Remember Paul Harvey? He used to say, over my shoulder, a backward glance. He was the king of turns of the phrases. Whenever he had some distressing piece of news, he'd say, and wash your ears out with this. Or if he would celebrate an anniversary, somebody had been married 73 years, he'd say, not all knots are slip knots. He was a master at the turn of the phrase. But before I get to my opening monologue, and then we're going to get to these calls that we look back on, I was very excited because the bakery that I go to was shut down during the lockdown. And I'm thinking when it first opened up, this is wonderful. But really, I don't need these cream sticks. I don't need these chocolate-covered cream sticks. They're not good for me. I'm going to try to avoid them. So I drove by there, and I saw they had really put out a spread. This was a spread unlike any that they had put out. I figured, well, all right, let me see what I do here. I'm going to pray the Lord. I said, Lord, it's up to you. If it's okay, if you want me to have any of those delicious things they got out there, please let there be a parking place for me directly in front of the bakery. That was my prayer. Figured, okay. Sure enough, on the eighth time that I drove by the bakery, the parking space was there. See? God answers prayers. Alrighty, let me see what my monologue is today. I got to look up it here. I put a little mark on here. Oh, yeah. I was 14 years old, and my dad said, Ram. They used to call me. My name when I was a little kid was Ramey. And then some of my friends growing up with still call me Ram. My dad said, Ram, take those four folding chairs downstairs. Now, there's four of them. I'm not going to make two trips. I'm 14. Not necessary. So I put two chairs under each arm, and I hoisted them up. I'm going to do it. I was doing pretty good. I was heading through the kitchen, moving along. I thought, these aren't heavy. I can handle this. So I got to the top step, and I stepped down. Well, the two chairs under my arms acted like two long crutches, and they hoisted me up off the ground. And I went face first down those steps, touching no steps, until I met and kissed the concrete floor. And the chairs were all around me. I got up. I was 14. I got up. And I don't want to think what would happen now if I fell from the second step down to the concrete floor. You know, a 18-inch fall. But I got up. My dad came running. My dad heard the crash. He came running. He looked down. Ram, you all right? I go, yeah, I'm okay, Pop. That fall did not hurt me. Not at all. I wasn't even so much as bruised. And I don't know why that was, but I wasn't so much as bruised, except my ego. But I did get those chairs down in one trip, so to speak. Is that fall good for me? If I say, well, I didn't get hurt, it's not going to hurt me, might as well do it again. Would that make any sense? I don't know how many such falls like that I could take before I truly got hurt. Bad. So I survived that first one. Unfortunately, this is often a rationale that people use, parents too, when a child is exposed to something via the media, via music, via social media, via TV, that really isn't good for their innocence and their morality. Ah, it's not going to hurt them. They're not going to go out and commit a crime. We got good kids. Not going to happen. So they see a few things. The rationale, it's not going to hurt them, is as foolish as me saying, instead of walking down the steps one at a time, I can take all 12 steps in one flying leap. Not going to hurt me. It didn't hurt me. Proof. That's how foolish that is. At a number of levels. One, if you want to raise a great kid, a virtuous kid, the question to ask is not, is it going to hurt him? The question to ask is it going to help him? Is it going to help me? Is it going to cooperate with my parenting as opposed to oppose my parenting? That's the first question. The second question is, what about the cumulative effect? How many of those falls could I have taken before I really did get hurt? I survived the first one. What about the second or third or fourth? What about the effect of repetitive flights, so to speak, down the steps? I wrestle with that rationale that people use because I'm thinking, what is the point? What are they really saying? Are they saying I'm too lazy to supervise this or to be vigilant about it? Are they saying my kid's a great kid so he can be pricked with some of the ugly stuff from our culture and it really shouldn't have any long-term effects? Are they saying, well, if he doesn't get into drugs or he doesn't commit crimes or he doesn't set fires, then it really didn't affect him? Oftentimes, how it affects him is subtle. It alters the way he looks at morality. It alters the way he looks at life. It alters the way he looks at religion. It alters the way he looks at the way his parents are raising him. Yeah. If I were to take a sip of some water that is laced with poison, it might not affect me. I could survive it and maybe wouldn't even have any ill effects. My body would fight it off. Well, what if I put a little bit more poison in there? Then I'd get sick. Maybe go to the hospital, but they saved my life. So really, ultimately, it didn't hurt me. But let's say that I took 9 sips of that water. I don't want to take my chances on that because it would hurt me. It could kill me. Don't ever use the rationale. It's not going to hurt him. What harm's it going to do? He'll be okay. Never use that rationale in deciding what to expose your child to. It is a faulty rationale. It will ultimately not help your parenting one whit. Always use the question, how will it help him? I'm Dr. Ray.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically own shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
We just did our parish mission a couple weeks ago now, and I suggested that in the course of the mission that we do something like a little mini spiritual assessment of our lives. I don't have to show this to anybody, but a great chance for us just to, with real honesty, just between us and Jesus, ask ourselves some questions. First question, given the fact that half of Catholics don't think God is even personal, would be to ask ourselves that. Do I think God is personal? And then to ask myself, do I think a relationship with Jesus is possible? Do I have a relationship with Jesus? And if so, what's it look like? And then perhaps a little bit more awkwardly or painfully, to ask Jesus, from his perspective, what's the friendship that we have with him look like? How would he describe our friendship with him? That might be a hard conversation to have.
This is Dr. Stan Williams. Why do Christians believe what they do? Not what, but why? What are the facts, evidences, and reasons for the Christian faith? Nineveh's Crossing has just released a new book titled Basic Christianity, Facts, Evidences, Reasons. It's a religious education course for teens through adults in Christian history, archaeology, and logic. Basic Christianity, available now at AveMariaRadio.net in the bookstore. Look for me, Dr. Stan Williams.
I am pretty good at multitasking. You know, we've done this research that says when you multitask, you kind of lose effectiveness on each of the individual tasks. I'm pretty good at multitasking. I can waste time, be unproductive, and procrastinate all at the same time. And I can do any one of them quite competently. Peter Kraft is my hero. I believe he is absolutely brilliant. He is a modern C.S. Lewis. This quote was sent to me by a friend. And this is wonderful when you folks send me these things because you are my wire services. You send me all kinds of neat stuff. This is a quote from Peter Kraft. God is the sculptor. We're the marble. Everything is his chisel. Let me say that again. God is the sculptor. We're the marble. Everything is his chisel. In other words, everything that happens to us, lives, people, situations, circumstances, all of which can be used to chisel us into something that our Lord wants us to be. And if you want to be what the Lord wants you to be, then you're obviously what you want to be. It's the best way to operate. Now, let's see where we're going to go. Let's see, is that about five, six, five? Francis has a daughter who is at college. And as is often the case, the kids go away to college. They have this quasi-independence. They think they're free. They can do what they want. They're out of sight, out of mind, even though mom and dad are footing the bill most of the time. The daughter's at college. She didn't want to come home for Christmas. Tells her how old this look back call is. She wants to go to her boyfriend's. And, Dan, are you letting Frances interrupt me before I'm even done here? Okay. She wants to go to her boyfriend's. Now, that's problematic enough. But the younger brother also goes to that college. And the daughter was supposed to bring him home. But if she doesn't come home, he doesn't come home. So let's talk to Francis.
Both of our older children, we have four, and both of our older children are going to the same college. One's a senior and one's a freshman. And the freshman is finished with his exams yesterday, and the senior is not until Wednesday. But she has decided, and she's the one with the car, that she's going to stay with her boyfriend's family where she was invited for a couple of days before she comes home, which is causing her brother to have to stay on campus an extra almost week. Well, about 3 days.
And what would you like with that?
Well, so I've read many, my husband and I both just admire you and read your books, and I was really hoping to play on her maturity and say, you know, what if the tables were turned, would you want this to happen to you? If, you know, and none of that is working, and so we always tend to have to resort to the financial leverage, which I hate doing.
Why? Whoa, Francis, stop. Why do you hate doing that? Do you owe her a college education? Do you owe her a college education?
No, and we assist with it. She's got multiple scholarships, so we do a very little bit, and we helped her a very little bit with her car. So she is kind of self-sufficient. She does depend on us for a few things, but I would just rather her do it on her, you know, because it's the right thing to do.
What would happen if you told your daughter, no, you can't do that, you need to come home?
Well, she would come home, I'm sure. She's obedient that way. It's just that it would be begrudgingly, and our whole, you know, Christmas would be like we're making her do stuff. And she's 22 years old, and I just wish that she would think things through a little bit and agree with us that what she's doing is selfish.
You're asking a much more difficult question. How do I make my daughter think right? That's what you're asking.
Yes,
good luck. Because the bottom line is, you're probably going to have to do this against her will, because you don't want her going to her boyfriend's house for a couple days anyway. You have no idea what kind of supervision those parents have over there. None. They may just leave. What do they care? That, you know, hey, this is great. This nice 22-year-old girl's here with our son. Hey, we're going out tonight. We'll be back around midnight. Bye, kids. Okay, that's one. And two, you're looking out for the well-being of your freshman, which is he, she shouldn't have to do that simply because the sister wants to. Now, you say, yeah, but look, see what we're doing. We're forcing her. And then she's going to be surly over Christmas. I'll tell you what, where I would be with that. You do what you want, but this is where I would be. If she comes home with a mood because she didn't get what she wanted, well, first of all, there's going to be some problems here financially. That's going to happen. I am not going to support you. Pay for your own phone now and leave the car here. Car stays
she
here.
She already knows all that. Yeah. There's only very limited things we can take away anymore.
Well, it's not a matter of taking away. First of all, she can't support herself. If you say to her, okay, if you want to do this, you're on your own. You are totally on your own. You put yourself through school. You pay your tuition. You pay all your expenses. You pay your room and board. Everything. If that's what she wants to do.
Okay.
But I don't think you'll do that, because most parents won't. They're nervous about doing that.
Oh, yeah, we've done that before. We did that before her sophomore year in college. So, yeah, we've done that. That's why I didn't really have to do it again.
Wait a minute. Francis.
There's a backstory.
Yes, there is a backstory. It sounds like there's a bit of a pattern here. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
What you really asked was, how do we make her agree with us? You don't. She doesn't agree with you.
Okay.
That's it. And if you have a right with the finances, sure. But even if she says, I pay for everything, you don't pay for anything, she's going to find out what it's like to pay for everything. Because when I talk to parents in your situation, and I ask them about what little bit they are supporting, very quickly it kind of turns into, it's not so much a little bit. There's a lot more support financially going on than the child.
Yeah, you're right.
I thought so. I know.
Yeah, you're right. And my husband agrees with you completely and wants to pull the plug, you know, today. And I'm like, oh, so I guess that's what we're going to do.
Well, I'm not telling you to do that. I can't tell you to do that. That's your decision. But you have every right to say you're coming home. And don't be a pouty face about it, because I'll tell you what, I'm not going to give gifts to somebody that's acting this way. Why would you?
Right.
All righty, dear.
Right.
Now, you see, the major issue here. And that is, it's so very common, especially with older teenagers and young adults. Francis makes a very, very legitimate request. It's Christmas break. Please come home and bring your brother. Shouldn't have to sit there for 3 days while you go to your boyfriend. Very legitimate request. She's allowed to make that request. Now, I never asked this, but I wanted to ask, who's paying for the car? Who's paying for the insurance? Who's paying for the gas? Who's paying for the license plates? Who's paying for the repairs? Now, I know that that daughter is not doing all that. That's a lot of money, and that's expensive. I know that's not happening. So, Francis makes the request. The daughter is upset. They don't want to do that. It's unfair. And mom's being unreasonable. Francis wants the daughter to look at this reasonably. Not likely, because there's a boyfriend involved. And that boyfriend means emotions. And whatever attachment she has to that boyfriend supersedes anything else. Supersedes her attachment to her family, supersedes her attachment to her brother, supersedes coming home for Christmas. It does. It's the way it is. Mom is going to have to live with the idea that her daughter is not going to agree. She's not going to say, I can see your point, Mom. I see what you're saying. I know I really want to do that, but you make a lot more sense, and you really have every right to ask me to do that because you're still kind of supporting me in a lot of ways, and I get it. I suspect not. You know why I suspect not? Did you hear what Francis said? Yeah, there's a backstory. Aha! Okay, so in other words, this is not the first time this young lady has wanted to do things that brought her into disagreement with her parents. Francis wants to make daughter understand. And I'm going to tell you, that's a great frustration of parenthood, trying to make kids understand. And Francis says, but I want her to do the right thing out of maturity. Did you notice what she said that? She said, I played on her maturity, and I want her to do the right thing to do. Well, what she was really saying is not I played on her maturity, because if there was maturity there, she would acknowledge, I may prefer to stay up here, but I understand that I don't really have the prerogative to do that. Now, that would be maturity. Obviously, that's not going to happen. So, Francis has to make a decision. Now, as I said, if it were me and she came home and she was surly and difficult, well, I'd probably have to sit down with her and say, you can't be like this. This is not good. And honey, I don't want you to be like this. If you're going to be like this, I have to tell you, you got no transportation. The car shut down. The car's not in her name. You think it is? I mean, that'd be rare that she bought the car. And it's in her name. I had a car when I was in college. I was 22. My mom and dad helped me out quite a bit with that car. Actually, no, that's wrong. I did not have a car in college. I got it the summer after I graduated the first time. So I would say to her, if you're going to be like this, I can't let you have the car. I'm not going to go out and buy a whole bunch of Christmas gifts if you're treating everybody badly. That's not being mean, by the way. See, parents think, boy, Dr. Ray, that's really harsh. Wait a minute. Mom didn't start this. If this young lady comes home and is obviously in a fit of pique for several days, kind of being surly and rude to siblings and mom and dad, wait a minute. Mom and dad didn't do anything wrong. It's the child acting this way. The young adult acting this way. It's not a matter of, I'm Gestapo, kid. I'm jackbooted. You're going to do what I say or get out. And it's not like that. It's a matter of, gee, you're going to be this way. I can't just simply say, oh, gee, I wish you wouldn't. That's just really too bad. That's, even at age 22, that may not be giving this young lady the right lesson. So, I wonder what happened. Wonder if Francis would hear this call and call me back and say, let me tell you what happened. My daughter walked to her boyfriend's and we went and picked up our son at college. I don't know.
Welcome to Spirit of Stewardship. Jeremy Belsky is your host for real-life stories, encouragement, and ideas to enhance your own gifts of work, wealth, and wisdom in response to God's blessings for you.
I'm Jeremy Belsky, and today's topic is Stewardship, a new spin on the money-back guarantee. We've all heard it. Your satisfaction guaranteed or your money back. A business will back its product regardless of the amount used or consumed. They know it's worth the expense in order to maintain the customer's future business. But what about stewardship and our effort to make it a way of life? How does being a good steward of our work, wealth, wisdom, and prayer guarantee anything? The analogy between a business's money-back guarantee and living a stewardship way of life each produces a result. With the business model, you get a new product. With the stewardship model, you get the lifelong opportunity to enter the kingdom of heaven through faith and good works. Jesus wants you to do good with what you have based on how he has blessed you. He shows his love and forgiveness through the sacrament of confession and shows encouragement and hope throughout our daily prayers to him. Jesus sees his gifts to you when he sees you give to others. We are all created in God's likeness and image. Thus, we all have different gifts to share. Perhaps two key questions to ask yourself to gauge your own level of stewardship is this: what am I giving? And how am I being called to increase my performance? Spend some quiet time in prayer, preferably in the presence of the Blessed Sacrament, and ask for God's guidance in living a stewardship way of life. Let His money-back guarantee bring you peace, love, and happiness. I'm Jeremy Belsky, your host for Spirit of Stewardship.
To learn how you can better share your talents and resources, contact your local parish priest. Your level of involvement in the church now positively impacts our faith in the future.
This is Dr. Ray Guarendi. The program The Doctor Is In, Monday through Friday, 1 o'clock Eastern Time. Co-production of Ave Maria Radio Communications and the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network, some 400 stations now, as well as Sirius, Channel 130. They almost kicked me off of Sirius, by the way. Yeah, because I was kidding around too much, not serious enough. Several weeks ago, we had a call. What makes a person narcissistic? And it was in the context of narcissistic personality disorder, which is much more extreme than just using the word narcissistic. That's a common misunderstanding. We talked about it a little bit, and she said, is it genetics? Is it upbringing? And it's a mixture of the two. Only God knows what mix. But I made the observation that we're in a very, very materialistically comfortable, highly entertainment-oriented culture. We get what we want. We're by far the richest culture the world has ever seen. Now, I came across this. Just want to throw these out for you. This was in the year 1900. Not that long ago. All right, this is roughly not even two lifetimes ago. My grandparents came from Italy in the early 1900s. So they knew this as children. The average life expectancy in the U.S. was 47. 14% of the homes in the United States had a bathtub. Now, keeping in mind, it's really hard to be self-centered when you kind of live with demanding circumstances. 8% of the homes had a telephone. Let's see what else. The average wage in the U.S. was 22 cents an hour. And my grandfather worked for 25 cents an hour. He used to say, Ramit, I dug a ditches. 95% of all births in the U.S. took place at home. Hold on here. Women, most women, only washed their hair once a month and used borax or egg yolks for shampoo. Now, there's a whole bunch of these. I'll give them a little bit later. Listen to the five leading causes of death in the U.S. were. Five leading. Like right now, it's heart attacks, then followed by stroke, and then I think cancer's third. Then, pneumonia and the flu were the top causes of death. Second, tuberculosis. Third, diarrhea. But listen to this one.
In 1900, now, that was 120 years ago, the number of reported murders in the U.S. was 230. It's roughly about six per state. We had 45 states then. Six per state. Recent weekend in Chicago, they had 18 murders in one day. What else? Just give you this one. What percent of Americans do you think graduated from high school? 6%. Yes, we've changed radically in terms of comfort, materialism, expectations, the good life. And when that happens, there are certain personalities that are kind of vulnerable to being self-absorbed, self-centered. Okay, I've got 4 minutes before I hit a hard break. Should I do it this way? Well, let me just give you some more of these stats. What I did is I used up a lot of time here for the hard break, and I've got a call that all of them are 4 minutes at least, so that would just take us to the break, and if anybody would come in after the break, they wouldn't know what I was talking about. Well, let me give you a few of these. Drive-by shootings in 1900. Teenage boys galloped down the street on horses and started randomly shooting at houses or anything else. That was an ongoing problem in Denver and other cities of the West. Las Vegas, Nevada. Now, right now, I went out to Las Vegas and did a talk about 15 years ago to the Las Vegas city schools. They were telling me that they were building one elementary school per month. I don't think it's like that now, but that's how fast they were growing. Population of Las Vegas, Nevada, 1900, 30 people. Handful of ranchers and their families. That's it. Insulin and antibiotics had not been discovered yet. So anybody with diabetes was going to die. It's that simple. 1 in 10 U.S. adults could not read or write. What else? Oh, this will shock you. Marijuana, heroin, and morphine were all available over the counter at corner drugstores. One pharmacist said this: heroin clears the complexion, gives buoyancy to the mind, regulates the stomach, and is in fact a perfect guardian of health. Heroin. Coca-Cola? Well, it didn't. Those of you who are nervous about Coke containing caffeine, it didn't at that time contain caffeine. It contained cocaine. Oh, but here's a shocker. 18% of households in the U.S. had at least one full-time servant or domestic help. 18%, 1900. 8,000 cars, 144 miles of paved roads. Radically different existence, not even two lifetimes ago. Radically. Just shows you how fast things have changed materially, culturally, technologically, health-wise, entertainment-wise. Most people didn't have entertainment. They lived to make themselves survive as best they could. My mother, she was born in 1927. My mom has four brothers buried underneath a pine tree across from a local hospital. She took me there once. They were not stillbirths. These were children who died in infancy. I think her one brother, Armando, and that's who I was named after, a year and a half old, maybe, two, something like that. Her mother had 13 pregnancies, five of whom survived. A very, very, very different existence not all that long ago. So the question becomes, does this feed into a sort of expectant, self-centered narcissism? Life is good. Life is the way I want it to be. People should act the way I want them to act. I'm the most important thing in the world. My needs should be met, and my wants should be met. And most of my wants, I now decide, are needs. Interesting. But we'll get to the calls when we come back. I want to talk about a young man who, well, he gave the school problems. He did. And his mom said, I'm not there. What can I do about this? On this Look Back Friday.
Bishop Robert Barron.
Find out in any cultural situation, who's the Lord? There's somebody or some principle, some figure, some institution that has central importance in that culture. Whether it's king, whether it's the military, who knows what it is? Go up and down the centuries. What's the Lord? The declaration of the Lordship of Jesus will always be a challenge to whatever that reigning Lord happens to be. The Lord today is my personal freedom. I decide what my life is. I decide who I am. I decide everything from my gender to the ultimate meaning of my life. Now that personal freedom is so powerful that it's become the Lord. To evangelize the culture is therefore to challenge them and to say, no, it's not your own ego, not your own freedom that's Lord. Jesus determines the meaning of your life. Jesus is the center of your life, not your own freedom.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Call to communion.
Through EWTN Radio, we talk to audiences all over the world. One thing I've found out is everybody in the whole world has the same set of questions. They live the same human life. They all want meaning. They all want love. They all want significance. They want forgiveness. That's the most fascinating thing to me. The same answers work wherever you are throughout the world, because we're all children of God.
Called to Communion with Dr. David Anders, this afternoon, 2 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at avemariaradio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to avemariaradio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
Lowest percentage of psychobabble on Catholic media, 1.26%. Lowest percentage in all media, 0.042%. Now, we can't get down to zero because our psychobabble meter is, it's not as sophisticated. It's not in a reiteration that should bring it all the way up. Because if I say something like, I listened to that one song by Sonny and Cher, it immediately reads Cher as psychobabble. For instance, well, I'd like to share that thought with you. So, yeah, we can't calibrate it to perfection, but we're getting down there. This is Look Back Friday. I'm Dr. Ray Guarendi. We're going to take a call, and then, as usual, I want to say a lot more about that call. So here we go. This is Katie from Ohio. 7-year-old son was put on a particular program that I advised her to do at school. And it's something that I did an awful lot when I was consulting to the schools in Columbiana County many years ago. Let's find out what Katie wants to tell us.
So my son, who's seven, he's in first grade. He's just kind of class clown, just always disrupting the class. And the teacher is really a sweet teacher, but she just had a problem controlling him. And I would get emails every day about he's disrupted in the class. I've tried everything. What can you do? And I told you because I know what I do with him at home. And he's a more difficult kid. He's number 4 or 5 kids. And he's kind of attention seeking. But you told me to have him get a little notebook and to go up to the teacher every day and have her rate his day, like excellent, good, fair, poor. And if it's a poor, it's like blackout. He knows what he's getting every day. And I tell you, the first, I tried it the next day, and it was right before Thanksgiving. And this is a hard time for kids, you know, in school because it's cold and Christmas is coming. But he was there at pickup, and he had his book in his hand, and he showed it to me. He forgot it one time, and he was on blackout, so he never did that again.
And one time.
One time. That's it, in like 5 weeks. Maybe
Jill.
Even 4 weeks.
Jill, now, do you realize what you've just said?
What?
You were thinking that your young man was just impervious to techniques. And the teacher was, too. The teacher's thinking, boy, I've tried everything with this little guy, and he just continues to be this way. What is going on? You were thinking that?
Yeah.
Were you not?
Yeah.
Sure, you were.
Tricky.
Sure you were.
He's
yeah.
Tricky.
Yeah. Jill, I'm going to tell you.
Well, this is Katie. Sorry.
I'm looking at the wrong place. Forgive me, Katie.
No, it's okay.
Forgive me. I just didn't want for granted. I call you by the wrong name every once in a while, and you have to realize, okay. Now, Katie,
no worries.
Here's the deal. Uh-huh. If I would have said to you, this is going to work, just do it once, you would have been sweet and you would have acknowledged. And you said, well, Dr. Ray, if you say so, okay. And then as you hung up, you'd have thought, he doesn't know what he's talking about. He doesn't know my son. That's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. We've been dealing with this mm-hmm. for 4 months. There's no way. Now, Katie, either I am exceptionally brilliant, which I wouldn't argue with, or or your little guy is nowhere near as impervious to discipline as you might have thought. You don't have a kid respond first time try something. And he says, okay, no mas. And that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that shows you, and this is a lesson I just want to say to every single parent listening. This is a huge lesson for all the parents who just think, I don't know what to do with this kid. He just seems so uh-huh. resistant and oppositional, and I can't figure it out, and we're all trying, and we've had 6 school meetings, and it's not getting any better. Uh-huh. Katie, I've been at this long time. I've seen thousands of kids and parents. And 90% of the time, if the parents do what we talk about, there is dramatic improvement. Dramatic.
Yeah.
Look at you.
Yeah.
Is now PTA Child of the Year.
Yeah, I mean, and I've talked to the teacher. She's like, he's doing so much better. I talked with the aide. She's like, I love him. He's so great. You know, he just needed a little bit of, you know, motivation or whatever. I mean, he's one of those kids that you talk about. He has been difficult since he started to crawl. He's one of those kids that pushes. But
no,
yeah, I mean,
no, Katie. Katie,
works.
I'm gonna argue with you. There's no way a kid who can be difficult and push him, and you do one trial discipline,
uh-huh.
and he responds.
Yeah.
I would have expected he would have had a sprinkling of pours, a sprinkling of fairs. Maybe he got a good thrown in there. Ooh, an excellent.
Well, no, he does get some fairs. He does get some fairs, and he mostly gets good. He's never gotten a pour. He does get some fairs, but I take away privileges at home.
You know what I think? Do you think it's possible?
What?
You said this. You said his teacher's real sweet and real soft and
uh-huh.
real nice. Do you
uh-huh.
think her grading system is a little inflated? In other words,
I do, because when I met with her, I told her what would happen if he got a pour, and that was probably my mistake.
That's exactly right. Yes. Absolutely. I deal with this all the time. When I was in the schools,
mm-hmm.
some of these really sweet teachers, no, that kill. Oh gosh, no, he's not that bad. Oh, gee, don't take all his privileges away. So what happens is she's never going to give him a pour.
I know. That's
all right, here's what you do. Try
so
this.
What should I do?
Go to her and you say, I've been thinking about it. When he gets a pour, I'm just going to take a privilege away. That's all. I'm not going to black him out. And then watch what happens. See if he gets more pours.
Okay.
All right?
Okay.
All right.
That's kind of a fib, but
I know. I figure out some way to say it so it's not a fib. I don't know how you can do it, but figure it out.
All right. Yeah. As soon as I said that, I was like, shoot, she's never going to give him a pour. That's what I was thinking.
Exactly what happens.
Yeah.
I know. Thank you, dear. Oh, so much to say at so many levels on this. First of all, education, perhaps even more than parenting, has absorbed a lot of very permissive ideas regarding limits and authority and discipline. Many of the younger teachers are educated in ideas that, and they've told me this, that are very frustrating because they don't work with particular kids, especially kids who push a little bit. They don't work well. The kid just runs over the teacher's authority. As a result, a lot of the teachers, particularly the younger ones, recently educated, are using a lot of quote-unquote psychologically sophisticated, unquote, techniques, and some of the kids are just eating them up alive. So as a result, the kids are behavior problems for them. And the teachers look at the kid and say, why is he like this? This is a tough kid. This is a tough kid. But in fact, in a good percentage of the cases, it's because the classroom discipline and structure is not that strong. Because it's not supposed to be. It's supposed to be kind of a looser sort of let's all just get along kind of thing. And Katie said some things that indicated that was the case with this teacher. That she just had a little tough time dealing with him. And it was confirmed when she said, I'm not going to give him a pour. Because I don't want him to lose all privileges. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to be an accessory to this kind of discipline overkill. Not going to happen. So she didn't do it. Now, here's what I could have suggested to Katie, but I ran out of time. I could have said, Katie, tell your son that he's going to get a blackout if he gets a fare. And watch what happens. Maybe the numbers of goods and excellence are going to go up real quick because he doesn't want to get a fare. He can get by with a fare because he loses one privilege. Goes to bed a little early or he doesn't get dessert or something. He loses one privilege, and that's not really enough motivation for him to kind of tone it down with his teacher because it's too much fun to kind of carry on. So he'll take his chances on a fare. That's what I would suggest. Now, boy, I don't have time. I'm going to have to deal with this at a later date, which is what happens when you have an older kid, like a freshman or a sixth grader or even a junior. You don't have one teacher. So how do you set this system up with more than one teacher? Now, there are ways to do that. But suffice it to say this. If the parent follows through at home with the system for a length of time, at least a month and a half, 2 months, almost never, and I can't recall a time, when I have not seen the child's behavior improve at school. And the younger the child, the quicker it improves. Almost never. The times that this system doesn't work, the excellent, good, fair, poor system doesn't work, is when the parent gets loose with it and doesn't follow through with it and skips a day or two or three or four or forgets to ask about it. That is when the system falls by the wayside. But if the parent follows through, it almost always makes things better. I'm Dr. Ray.
Now, wait a second. Let's talk this over. I'm not a rabbi for nothing, you know. I think I have a solution. Just wait a second.
I'm Dr. Stan Williams, and this is the Evidences for Christianity. Some people will say that religion is personal and therefore outside the purview of objective examination. As Christians, we cherish the feelings and impressions we get from having a personal relationship with God. So how do we know such feelings and impressions are trustworthy? St. Paul says to test everything. And how do we test subjective feelings? A well-formed conscience is a start, but how do we properly form our conscience? Again, St. Paul writes, study to show yourself approved, rightly interpreting the word of truth. And what is the foundation of that truth? How about the historical facts, archaeological evidences, and the logical reasons that established the Church of Jesus Christ? To explore more, go to AveMariaRadio.net. Under resources, look for me, Dr. Stan Williams.
Did you know you have divine glory living within you? If you are a baptized Christian, you are host to a gentle guest, says the Catholic Catechism. This guest inspires, guides, corrects, and strengthens us to live our life in Christ. That gentle friend is the Spirit of Christ, the third person of the Blessed Trinity, the Holy Spirit. He is active in us, transforming us spiritually if we are willing, so that we may live as children of the light. There are two ways to live. The first way, the way of Christ, leads to life. The opposite way leads to death, an eternity without God. Choose life, then. Choose Christ, a life of challenge and joy. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Good to have you with me here on The Doctor Is In. I am Dr. Ray Guarendi, fixated in a little Freudian lingo on the oral stage. In other words, used to talking. And this Look Back Friday is a chance for me to talk more and more and more and more, because there are so many things I wish to say when we get a live call that, well, for the reasons of exigency and time, I can't. So some of the calls make the Look Back roster, and then I get to say a lot more about them. However, I do miscalculate. And the timing is critical on this. And because the last break I went on for quite a while on the excellent, good, fair, poor approach to dealing with kids' behavior at school, I've only got a few minutes left. And the look back calls I have up there on the roster are longer than that. So I will do what I sometimes do, is to quote C.S. Lewis. You know, I'd like to start quoting Peter Kreeft, too, because he just has so many brilliant, pithy, spiritually oriented sayings and phrases and observations and insights. This is Lewis from Mere Christianity. No one knows how bad he is, and I'm a little nervous about using the word bad, because we're in God's eyes, we are created good, but bad meaning potential for sin, until he has tried very hard to be good. And isn't that the truth? That is what is called by the shrinks as cognitive dissonance. If you will notice, those folks who try to walk as closely as they can to Christ notice more things about themselves that need to be changed, that need to be improved. The people who, by and large, think they're very good people are those who, for the most part, don't self-scrutiny. They don't need to. Far as they're concerned, I'm a good person. And how do they define I'm a good person? What is it that they've determined, and this is their own judgment, by the way, because they generally don't put it up against any moral plumb line other than I haven't shot anybody, I don't cheat on my taxes, and I'm faithful to my spouse. And a few other things thrown in here and there. In other words, it's a lack of negatives. I'm a good person means I don't do bad things that much, not compared to other people. So Lewis is making the observation, you really try hard. You try very, very hard to be a follower of Christ. You look at yourself. You see the areas that you never noticed before. I know many of you have been Christians for a long time. And is it safe to say that now, in your Christian walk, you are much more aware of things about you that don't mirror Christ? You didn't notice them 20 years ago. You didn't realize you did that or thought that or said that. You didn't. You were kind of just sort of comfortable with how good you were. But as you got closer to Christ, it's kind of like getting close to a bright light. You move closer to a bright light, it shines on you. And you notice flaws that you didn't notice before. Now, this doesn't mean you despair. It doesn't mean you say, oh, I'm just a wretched, worthless piece of doggy poo. You don't do that. But at the same time, it is a good thing to know that with God's grace, you can start to not only see those things, but do something about them. And as you walk closer to Christ, and that's part of where the cognitive dissonance comes in. On the one hand, You want to get closer to Christ. But on the other hand, as you do, you see there are more things that he would like changed about you. I know. That's what Lewis is saying. You try really hard to be good. Then you realize, oh, how much about you is not necessarily all that good. But that still means you're infinitely valuable in God's eyes. I got to run. Good Lord permit, and see you Monday on our E-Person Monday. Thank you, Dan McGraw, for taking care of things, editing those calls. Walk with God. Hold your children very tightly by the hand.
For information on Dr. Ray's presentations, books, and CDs, visit DRA.com and follow him on Facebook. The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Have a good day.